Tony Fletcher is the best-selling author of major biographies on Keith Moon, The Smiths, and R.E.M., as well as a memoir, a novel, and a history of the New York City music scene. He is the author of the brand-new book, In the Midnight Hour, The Life and Soul of Wilson Pickett, and it is a great pleasure to welcome our good friend Tony Fletcher back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure having you on the program.
Hey, it's always a pleasure to be here, Joe.
Thank you very much. What brought you to want to explore this life of Wilson Pickett?
In the long run, the fact that, like many people of my British generation, I think soul music is instilled in our kind of musical psyche. I think if you're into 60s rock groups, and I did write about Keith Moon of The Who, I think you're also into 60s soul music, and that means Stax as well as Motown. And I grew up knowing Wilson Pickett's biggest hits. A few years back, I did a road trip, went to Memphis, went to the Stax Museum, and kind of immersed myself a bit deeper. And at one point, listening to Wilson Pickett, just realized, I don't think there's a book on this guy. And looked on my bookshelf, didn't see one. Looked online, didn't see one. I thought, well, the voice is good enough. There's enough hits. Maybe the life wasn't that interesting. So I did some cursory research on his life, and I thought, well, that's not the case. So clearly there was a gap on the shelves, but something that I wanted to write about, something that I actually wanted to tell that story because of a love of soul music.
As I just came into the studio and I was sitting down with you, I said to you, you know, it's an amazing book, but my God, what a life this man had.
Really?
And it is fascinating. So let us try to unpack some of that and the impact ultimately that life had on the music. Tell us a little bit about his background.
Well, one of the things I thought was fascinating about writing about Wilson Pickett was, in the larger scheme, you can actually tell the story of American black music through maybe a 30, 40, even 50-year period, because he was born in the cotton fields of Alabama and raised very, very much on gospel music. I mean, raised in pretty much abject poverty, very large family. Followed his father later followed his father north to Detroit in the second wave of the Great Migration. So he was in Detroit by the late 50s, singing with vocal rhythm and blues groups. He was there at the birth of Motown. He was around all those performers, around Berry Gordy and various members of Temptations and Supremes, etc. Went to New York City after having a big hit with the Falcons, I Found a Love, which is still a tremendous recording. And there in New York City, dabbled with the Brill Building sound, signed with Atlantic Records. Atlantic eventually wised up and sent him down to Memphis to record at Stax. He was the first Stax artist to record at Memphis. He was then the first Stax artist to record at Fame in Muscle Shoals. And I'm sure a lot of us saw that Muscle Shoals documentary that's been on a lot over the years. He was the first Atlantic artist to record in Philadelphia with the wonderful sound of Philadelphia people, the Sigma Sound Studio, the Philly Soul people. And sort of on and on it went until in the 70s, a lot of the artists like Wilson Pickett, who had been raised hard on gospel music. I mean, he was a shouter. He was a foot stomper. As soul music got more synthetic and more sequenced and gradually morphed into disco, there was no place for these people to go because they didn't have that in them. And then the downfall was very hard. So you've got a rise and you've got a fall here.
Even with the downfall, there's still a very long period of good music production. How much of a transformation was there during that period in his sound, or was it fairly consistent?
His sound was really that of somebody who was born with a vocal gift. He could not just sing, and in the gospel world, it is called shouting, you know, shouting to the Lord.
Yes.
He could do that, but he could scream. And there are many people. James Brown is famous for his scream, but as was noted by his primary record producer and mentor, Jerry Wexler from Atlantic, when James Brown screamed, it was a scream. When Wilson Pickett screamed, it was in tune. He had this ability to scream with a kind of scream. I mean, if think of Roger Daltrey and Won't Get Fooled Again and the damage that did to that guy's voice. Pickett could do that song in, song out every day of the week, and his voice was just absolutely fine. So part of that was fortuitous. I think the thing that really, I think, distinguishes him is that I would classify him as the archetype of the soul singer. So you can definitely make an argument that James Brown was a more influential artist with greater longevity because he had hits back in the 50s. You could argue that Otis Redding and Sam Cooke are more tragic stories because they died young and had maybe sweeter voices. But I don't think there's anybody who could deliver with that much, not just volume, but emotion, and keep doing it and keep doing it. And you were asking, in the 1970s, I think the songs started to suffer, and I think the arrangements started to suffer, and eventually his voice did. But he carried a very, very, very strong voice right through to the end.
One of the things that I found fascinating about the book, and you do this in much of your writing, which I really enjoy, is telling us a story so much about the affiliation with the labels as well, with Atlantic, with Stax, how important that relationship was. Talk a little bit about why that is so fundamental, not only to the artists and to their success, but even to their sound.
I always maintain that the things that I like writing about are scenes and understanding that nothing happens in a vacuum. Everything's kind of happening because of circumstances surrounding it. For Pickett, he had a couple of hits. I mentioned I Found a Love with the Falcons. His first solo hit was If You Need Me, which was produced up in Detroit and was a hit for Lloyd Price. If you need me, call me. If you need me, yeah, call me. Don't wait too long if things go wrong. I'll be home. Now, there's the thing. Lloyd Price was a great name in his own right, but as a label boss, couldn't get on with Pickett and eventually let him go to Atlantic Records. And even initially at Atlantic, actually, Jerry Wexler did make a couple of mistakes. They produced a couple of records that just weren't right for Wilson Pickett. Wilson claims it was he who wanted to go down and record at the Stax Studios in Memphis after hearing Otis Redding. But I think it's amazing with Atlantic, because if you were to pick up, there was a 6-CD box set, of which 5 CDs are the original recordings and one bonus. There's really, once he gets down to Memphis, there's not a bad track amongst them. And the relationship is fascinating between Jerry Wexler and Wilson Pickett. They're two very strong-headed people. They butted heads a lot. There was a love for each other, a respect for each other. And what I do have to say is, for as long as Wilson Pickett was with Atlantic, there were ups, there were downs, there were arguments, but there are very few recordings that you would skip over. Very few. There were B-sides, album tracks that just stand as great recordings, whether or not they were hit records and regardless of who they were recorded with. So while I could easily name Funky Broadway or Land of a Thousand Dances, I could say go listen to Toehold. All my life I've been a poor boy. It's been hard to get a dime. Everything I got, I had to pay for it on time, but that's all right. Go listen to any number of the Bobby Womack songs that Pickett recorded. They're all of them very good. In 1971, he cut loose from Atlantic over money, which it was bound to be. And the soul thing was changing, and Jerry Wexler actually let a couple of the artists go. He went to RCA Records, bigger label. They gave him $1 million. They carried on paying him all the way through his contract. His career nosedived. I note in the book that I don't know of any bigger, greater example of a career hinging on that one decision. You go for the money, you get the money, but there's no mentorship. There's no Jerry Wexler there. Right. And your career's over almost overnight.
And especially with a changing music scene on top of it.
Well, with a changing music scene, and you could potentially argue that Wexler was a little heartless, letting Solomon Burke go, letting Wilson Pickett go, recognizing right. that their time as hit makers and money makers for Atlantic was over. But RCA thought otherwise, and RCA was able to sell records by a lot of other black artists at the time. So clearly they sort of knew what they were doing, but you needed, Pickett was somebody who needed somebody who would stand up to him. He was a very, very strong personality. When you hear his voice, that's pretty much what he was like in real life. Massively charismatic. The kind of person who, I saw similarities with Keith Moon, this kind of person who would walk into a room and fill it. If he was walked into the room behind you, you would kind of know he'd walked into the room. You would feel this presence in the room. He needed somebody who could stand up to him and say, no, don't record that, record this. No, that's not good enough. We're going to do it again. And Atlantic would do that, though often Pickett songs didn't need to be recorded again on Atlantic. Atlantic would do that. RCA didn't. And from the mid-70s onwards, things were rough for him for 20-odd years till he had a bit of a comeback at the end.
Was Motown ever a temptation?
Oh, I like the pun. I don't think so, because he, like I say, he was very much around that scene. The person who set up the Falcons record label, a guy called Robert West, who was Eddie Floyd's uncle, the Falcons also included, just so we know, the great singers, Eddie Floyd, Sir Mac Rice, and Wilson Pickett, and also Joe Stubbs, who was Levi Stubbs' brother, Levi Stubbs from the Four Tops. So they were very, very much around at the birth of Motown. Berry Gordy was at their recordings. I think Berry Gordy had a pop vision, and Wilson Pickett knew he was a soul shouter, even if it wasn't called soul at that point. And I think that Pickett definitely made the right decision. I could almost imagine him in something like The Temptations or as a solo artist, but I think he would have been hampered by Motown's material. And there is this massive difference between Motown and Stax. And although Pickett was never actually on the Stax label, we identify him with Stax, he was more of what you consider the Southern soul singer than the kind of Northern Detroit Motown singer.
We have been talking primarily about his professional life. Let's talk a little bit about his personal life. How, for want of a better term, was it under control during those good years and during those productive years?
I think he had it wonderfully under control during those good years. It was very interesting to me that I interviewed his ex-common-law wife, his ex-partner, Dovey Hall, who was a few years older than him. And she said that when they met, which was 1962, by which point he was already performing solo. He'd left the Falcons. He'd had that really big hit, I Found a Love. She said although he was poor, he was completely committed to his career. He didn't drink. Was way too busy for that. They moved to New York. They literally hitched a U-Haul on the back of their car and went to New York. And for the first few years, a lot of people around him said he was a hard taskmaster, very, very familiar phrase that I heard. But he was largely in control of his emotions. I mean, I tell a story about him pulling a gun on his brother in a car in Brooklyn, but I think there was a certain amount of sibling rivalry that went deep. He was largely, I think, in control. There are too many people say that Pickett led studio sessions, always had an instinct for me to think that during his heyday, he wasn't very, very much in control of his faculties and not partying hard.
You quote him in an interview with the Boston Phoenix saying, I went into a Great Depression. I said, to hell with it. I was getting nowhere. I was sinking my own money into recording projects and never getting my money back out of it. So I thought I might as well relax with this. I didn't relax, though. I got very depressed. I went into my house and I didn't come out for about 10 years. I just went to the grocery store or the post office. Sometimes I'd sneak out and go fishing. People thought I was dead or something. They would drive by and try to peek to see if they could see Wilson Pickett. They'd ring the bell, but I didn't answer. I didn't want to talk to nobody.
Sad, isn't it?
It is. At what point is this?
This would be his reflecting back on the 80s into the early 90s. And things did get very, very bad. And it's a shame. It's never easy to write about this, about somebody that you essentially admire. I mentioned the RCA thing. He had the Las Vegas lifestyle. He started doing drugs, a lot of cocaine. His violent tendencies that were always there became very commonplace. There was a lot of physical violence, both with his partner and even with band members. His partner, Dovey, eventually left him after 15-odd years. He had a succession of female partners. He got arrested several times. He ended up having DW. He actually got jailed twice, once for DWI, very, very bad incident, and another time for, unfortunately, domestic violence under the influence of cocaine. The second time seemed to actually, it seemed like he really did hit a rock bottom and came out of it. He was never completely sober. He was never completely reconciled or reformed, I should say. But he hit a rock bottom and came out and determined to build himself back up. But he had a bit of an endless parade of recording an album for one label, maybe an EMI. He went back to Atlantic for one album. He even went to Motown for one album in the late 80s. And it was an okay album, but a tour in Europe fell apart after one of his younger bandmates actually fought back against him and almost blinded him in the eye. And Motown said, enough of this. So it's a very, very, very sad period. And like I say, there's no joy in having to write about that. I was really glad that at the end he got to make one very good independent album that got nominated for a Grammy before his kind of body gave up on him at the age of 64. So there's a nice ending to this. It's not just rock bottom. There's a good album at the end. But it's still sad having to follow somebody through that period.
And I assume he was like many artists who deal with this. They're looking for that big comeback, right? They're looking for the return to what they had at one point.
They are, and their expectations tend to be very, very high because they've been that successful. And his final producer, a guy called John Tiven, who was very helpful with me on this book, the exact quote is in the book, but he talks about Wilson's over-expectations and says something about to the effect of how when you've been to the top of the mountain, getting halfway back up it is somehow not enough. And the album that he recorded called It's Harder Now, which is quite a good pun all around, Grammy nomination should have done him. And he got to go to the Grammys. In fact, there's this great interview quote right before that album comes out. He says, I've got the money. I never blew the money. All of that's good. I've sold records. All I want now is a Grammy. And he gets nominated. And it's a category for older R&B artists, and they're all kind of on their comebacks. And Barry White wins. I'm not going to say which is the better album. For most people, just getting to go to the Grammys and feeling you got nominated would have been enough. And John told me that he was distraught that Barry White won. Mm. And so the night for the party turned into another of these nights where he kind of hit the bottle and couldn't accept that he was halfway back up the mountain. He wanted to be on top.
When you think about this, even in that quote I read, but in your telling of the story of that period, there not only seems to be just a depression over what is happening and the money he has put in and the personal capital that he is losing, but also an embarrassment, it seems.
Do you mean in terms of him being embarrassed or we're embarrassed to read about it?
Meaning that he was embarrassed by having been on the top and now not being there anymore.
I think you're right. One of the things that's interesting with addicts, and he became an addict. He wasn't born that way, but he did become an alcoholic and a drug addict. So I think, as with Keith Moon, who had similar tendencies, the drugs follow the alcohol. They don't necessarily come first. He's still one of those people that when he was needed, he could switch it on. So when he was in public, people generally saw the Wilson Pickett they wanted to see. There's a great film called Only the Strong Survive, which came out very late in his career, and he dominates that film. It's all about basically the soul singers who survived. He dominates that film with his personality. It helps that he's having this comeback, but you get that feeling. Here's a guy who can switch it on. But I think that at the same time, you have to look at what's he doing the other 6 days of the week. If he's got one show a week, maybe at a casino that pays his way, or an oldies night, or he'd often team up with James Brown. Those two had an incredibly turbulent respect and feud between them all the way through. He could turn it on for that one night. He could get paid. It would keep him in the lifestyle to which he was accustomed. But how's he feeling the other few days? And I think that I get the sense of being somewhat embarrassed for him, and I think he probably feels embarrassed that he's not the person he was. But he's also not somebody who would have found apologizing easy, wasn't somebody who would have gone to a shrink, wasn't somebody that would have taken advice easily. That's a lot of that's a product of the environment. If you start the story at the beginning, it's a really tough environment, and he sort of fought his way out of it. He never sufficiently mellowed to allow anybody in to really, really help him to the degree that he could have benefited from that.
Your writing about the relationship between he and James Brown is fascinating. It's a really interesting relationship. And obviously, it's a rivalry too, isn't it?
It's an enormous rivalry. James was there first, no denying it. I definitely would claim Wilson to be the better singer. I think that Wilson's voice is just unassailable within soul music. James Brown had more ambition, without doubt, and James Brown was interested in being the leader of a movement, of being some kind of social spokesman. James Brown was interested in mentoring other artists, but Wilson dabbled in that and then really didn't handle it. I think Wilson just wanted to be what he was, the archetypal best soul singer, but he never liked the idea that James Brown was considered a better singer, or that people would, you know, he was. So James Brown is soul brother number one. And I didn't mention earlier that really probably the high point of Pickett's career was when he got to headline the first ever Black American musical package to go to Africa. Went to Ghana in 1970, and he was the headline artist by a long, long stretch. And the film of that concert called Soul to Soul just shows the most. The audience is just crazy for him, but they called him Soul Brother Number Two, and they meant it as a term of respect. He was mad. He was like, you do not call me that. Don't call me that. So yes, there was always this rivalry, and it plays out in a number of occasions. There's one time that James Brown calls in Pickett and says to him, you know, Pickett, you're a great singer, but you know what your problem is? Pickett says, what's my problem? He says, you ain't black enough. And Pickett's thinking, I ain't black enough? Have you seen the color of my skin? I'm the blackest dude out there. But I think he meant, hey, I'm doing Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, and you're still singing Hey Jude, so get with the program. And yeah. So that sort of shows where there was a feud. I would argue that Pickett had the just as soulful a voice.
But the other thing too that is interesting is that James Brown certainly had his ups and downs. My God, had his ups and downs. But he never went away. I mean, even up until his death, he was still out there recording. There was really not a fallow period.
Well, there was a fallow period where James couldn't sell records the same way Pickett couldn't sell records. I think I went to see James Brown in London. It would have been in the 80s, the first time I saw him in concert. I walked out when he'd sung it, There's No Business Like Show Business. I couldn't bear to see it.
That seems like a very sad thing to witness.
So I think both artists had their difficulties. Maybe James Brown was probably saved by hip-hop, because yes, hip-hop sampled James Brown relentlessly, and he came back into the fold. People really had to work out how these artists could get paid. A whole new financial model came in. They didn't sample Pickett to the same extent. I think it brought James Brown right back to the fold.
And I guess that's what I mean more than a fallow period, but he had the comeback that artists looked for. He's still being introduced as the godfather of soul. He was out there, he was making money, he was touring.
Yes.
There was a lot going on.
There was a lot more going on. I think he maintained that ambition all along to be the hardest working man in show business. Pickett was more interested in getting paid and working reasonably, but not being the hardest working man.
So for my final question to you, ultimately, what do you think the Wilson Pickett legacy is and will be through music history?
I think twofold. On a superficial level, pick up any of the many greatest hits packages, and I run into quite a few people say, okay, Wilson Pickett, I think I know the name. And I say, well, In the Midnight Hour, Land of a Thousand Dances, Mustang Sally, Funky Broadway, Don't Let the Green Grass Fool You, Engine Number 9, Don't Knock My Love, that version of Hey Jude.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let her in your heart, then you can start to make it better.
And they say, oh wow, all the one person. That musical legacy is again unmatchable. But I think on a deeper level, what I'm really hoping this book shows, apart from the troubled personality and the roller coaster ride that maybe makes for I'll put it in quote marks, a fun read, I think the fact that this guy was at the vanguard of Black American music for a long time. He was not just following the way, he was leading the way. And I think that that's where he deserves to be elevated in musical history, as somebody who actually was opening doors at the very forefront of changing styles in Black American music and really paving the way for other artists. And he did that several times over before the scene finally caught up with him. To my mind, that puts him up there in his own way with people that passed away last year, like a David Bowie, yeah, who could constantly be ahead of the game, fell into a period where the game caught up with them, but we remember them for being a game changer, and I think that's what Pickett was during his heyday.
Tony Fletcher's new book is In the Midnight Hour, The Life and Soul of Wilson Pickett. It is published by Oxford University Press. Tony Fletcher, it's always a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for being with us and for just a terrific book.
Thank you for having me in, Joe.
Great,
it's
pleasure.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Again, the name of the new book, In the Midnight Hour, The Life and Soul of Wilson Pickett. The book is published by Oxford. Tony Fletcher is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.